Hello, Peter Lynham.
And how are you going there, Johnny?
I'm good. We've got a new king.
Yes, yes, indeed. I can't get used to the notion of Charles III. The previous Charleses have been pretty unseemly, and I'm not sure this one's going to be much different. But did you watch, by any chance, the Accession Council? It was shown on TV3 on Saturday evening. You probably had better things to do.
I have not seen one bit of coverage of the Queen's passing. I haven't watched anything on television. So,
yeah.
Fill me in, Peter. What did I miss?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's been wall-to-wall coverage, but the bit that really interested me was that when there's a formal process by which the king is declared to be king by the Privy Council. So this is the Privy Council, which is basically all previous cabinet members, stretching back, and there were 718 of them in England, and so they were all invited to appear, and the king shows up, and he has to agree that he will. Firstly, they go and they petition him that he will accept the role of king on conditions that he will be effectively a constitutional monarch, that he will act in cooperation with his cabinet, and then he's brought in. This is all taking place St James's Palace, which I've never seen inside before, and then he was made to sign an oath, and this was a truly extraordinary oath. So the oath, let me see if I can bring up the text of it. It was really quite amazing. Now, where is it? Yes, that he will. I, Charles III, by the grace of God of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of my other realms and territories, King Defender of the Faith, do faithfully promise and swear that I shall inviolably maintain and preserve the settlement of the true Protestant religion as established by the laws made in Scotland, in prosecution of the claim and right, and particularly by an act entitled An Act for Securing the Protestant Religion and Presbyterian Church Government, and by acts passed in the Parliament of both kingdoms for the union of two kingdoms, together with the government, worship, discipline, rights, and privileges of the Church of Scotland. So help me God. And he signed the form. Now, this was truly extraordinary. You'd think, why of all things to mention, and that he has to sign a grand document witnessed by Nicola Sturgeon, the Chief Minister for Scotland. It doesn't say anything about he'll protect the Church of England, doesn't say anything, really much about anything else except protecting the Church of Scotland.
Have they had a history of interfering?
Yeah.
Or?
There is history here. There is fascinating history here. Charles I lost his head. This is terribly relevant for the present Charles III, although every monarch has signed this since 1707.
Like to the guillotine or just broadsword?
There was sword. Yep. There was no guillotine in 1641 when the king died.
Okay.
1649 when the king died.
Chopped his head off with a sword.
But he died because effectively he got offside both with the House of Commons in England, and he was trying to impose bishops on the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And so the Scots allied with the House of Commons and defeated the king at Naseby.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first factor. And then subsequently, when in 1707 they decided to unite the crown, so because up to that stage he was separately King of Scotland, kings were King of Scotland and King of England. And then they created the United Kingdom. And when they created the United Kingdom, there was one condition that it was thought that Parliament, that the Scots would never agree to this if there wasn't some guarantee that the Church of Scotland did not have bishops. And that has been a condition on monarchy, in effect, virtually the only written condition on monarchy ever since. Lots of other conventions are there which may, you know, reduce the powers of the king, but this one is the one he has to sign and swear in order to be recognised as king.
Mm.
And what this tells you is that the Scots were prepared to die in the famous National Covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, back in 1637. They were prepared to die in order to not have bishops in their church.
How do they feel about it in the modern era?
Well, I don't know that anybody's ever asked them, but the thing is this, that they, when the king or the queen is in Scotland, they are Presbyterians, not Anglicans.
Mm.
This is quite intriguing. And they're the King of Scotland, but this is a special little deal that in Scotland they become Presbyterians, but they don't have the powers in Scotland, which they have in England, as being the defender of the faith and the chief, the supreme governor of the Church of England. That's the role of the king, which when the coronation, when we finally have this huge, massive coronation business that lasts about 5 hours, then the king will pledge to be defender of the realm, a defender of the faith, and supreme governor of the Church of England. But even before he can start, he has to agree that he is just an ordinary member of the Church of Scotland.
Yes.
His only role is to ensure that they never have bishops and
okay.
that he won't interfere.
But clear this up for me. So while King Charles is cruising around in Buckingham Palace, he is an Anglican, but if he goes up to Scotland and visits a church, he's a Presbyterian.
That's right. Now, there is...
What's the difference between an Anglican and a Presbyterian? Is there much... Does he...
Anglicans have bishops.
Yes.
Presbyterians, Christ is the only head of the church.
Okay.
And so the Presbyterians have committees.
Hmm.
And the Anglicans have bishops. That's effectively the difference.
Yes.
But this is held ardently, more in the past than in the present, but ardently in Scotland.
Yes.
That bishops are bad.
Okay.
And that they never want another king trying to force bishops on them.
Okay.
It's a weird relic of a past age.
Yes.
That this is the one public declaration he had to sign. But it probably tells us, I mean, in these days when the United Kingdom is a pretty fragile institution, and when the bits, you know, the Scots have come very close to wanting to secede, that pledges like this matter a huge amount because they say Scotland is different.
Yes. So have the Scots talked about becoming a republic in recent years?
No, not a republic, but a separate kingdom to dissolve the United Kingdom. And so therefore, if that happened, then the king would be as in New Zealand, you know, where we had the declaration at the Accession Council. Ours took place at Sunday lunchtime. But not quite as much grandeur as was done in Westminster, I can tell you. The trumpets didn't sound nearly so splendid. And there were no fancy soldiers marching around with funny hats. But presumably what would happen would be that then a King of Scotland, he'd need to be declared King of Scotland in a separate ceremony.
Do they have a royal family in Scotland, a Scottish royal family?
Well, this, of course, the thing is that all this goes back to the fact that the monarchs after Queen Elizabeth I died It was the monarchs of Scotland who were brought in to take over the Kingdom of England. So the English kings for a century were the Stuarts, who were Scottish kings in origin.
Okay.
So there's a strange, tangled history, even though from 1714 that line died out and they landed on the Dukes, a German branch of the family was dragged in, and so the present monarch's most direct descent is through a German family of Mecklenburg.
Okay.
Yes, but you don't need to bother about that. I'm just intrigued that religion was once so spiky, so difficult, that this was the one thing the king had to preach.
And it's crazy that it's still preserved to this day.
It is. It's most astonishing
bizarre.
That it's still very bizarre, but made for great viewing.
Yes. Hey, Peter Lynham, thank you very much for this week's edition of That's the Spirit. We'll check in with you next week.
Excellent. Very good.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.